Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I think most people here know that recently got back from a short tudong, a practice that we do in the Thai forest tradition of just walking on faith. And there's many different ways that you can do the practice, many different intentions you can have behind it. Going, seeking out holy places, if you're in a country where there's lots of, say, Buddhist monks or teachers around, you could be, you know, having an intention to seek out various teachers or various centers you wanted to go to. Could just be seeking solitude, trying to find a place where you could just sit and meditate, you know, some place where there'd be, you could get alms food and be shelter. And just, you know, not actually doing any walking at all. So there's many different ways to approach it. In California, if you're doing it, tends to be the distances between the towns and the villages kind of, you know, dictate how far you have to walk if you don't stay in one place for any period of time. So a lot of our walks that we've done in the past have been, I wouldn't say necessarily endurance walks, but you know, a lot of it is putting in many miles. Since I've been back, I've been reflecting on the walk, you know, thinking about it quite a bit. Initially, when I came back, I gave a morning reflection the very first day. Just the very first impression I got coming back and thinking about it was just the requisites, paying attention to everything that you needed, you had to carry on your back, and just noticing, you know, like what it was that we really, really needed for that comfort or for that safety. And it was pretty interesting how they all of those requisites that we needed were, you know, things exactly that the Buddha had us reflect on every day, just looking at food, medicine, shelter, and clothing. And in particular on this, because we didn't have any lay support. It was just myself and another monastic walking, generously driven over to the coast, and the two people from the monastery that offered to take us over provided the transportation. So there's generosity there. And then they provided a lunch for us, the meal for that day. But after that, we had to pretty much depend on, you know, what was in our backpacks, and then the generosity of the people that we met. So, you know, in that situation, it was really, even though we had very, very small sort of shelters, I just had a poncho that was, brilliantly designed into a sleeping area, and is actually large enough to even sit in meditation under. And it was good for blocking the winds, which the California northern coast is notorious for very strong winds. And so it worked perfectly. So shelter was the biggest sort of concern. And then the second biggest is food. And that was abundantly provided. In most days, it was, you know, completely spontaneous. There were a few days that we had been invited to go out to, say, like these, you know, a lunch or a picnic kind of thing. But several days, it was just completely on alms, being an alms mendicant, and just taking an alms bowl and going, walking through a town, and where nobody knew us in particular, nobody was looking for us, and just was provided. So that was initially how I was, you know, just reflecting on that aspect of the walk. Then, I've been continually bringing it up, and And I was talking today with somebody. Went into the town of Willits on alms round, and just a couple of weeks ago we had actually a Upasaka day, and the subject was the Tudong, and talking about it in many different ways as well. And one of the, in the discussion, it's like, as a layperson, it's like, most people aren't gonna have the opportunity just to, take off for a week or a month and just start walking. And, it may not even, work for as a layperson. There's some advantages to, many advantages to wearing robes. And, it does bring that, if you're out there, just walking on faith, it does bring some attention to you. People, they get a sense of you're doing something different, and it can. I think one of the beauties of the Tudong practices is it actually attracts, I would say, intelligent people to you, intelligent or inquisitive, generous. Every single day we had encounters with people. And and the types of people that we did have encounters with were these type of people that were, wanting to help, wanting to support, or just inquisitive, and so it's a really good quality of persons to be around. So there's a real joy that can come from the Tudong practice. And I think what came up, I was asking the person who drove, they also had attended the Upasaka Day on Tudong, what was the biggest thing that they had gotten from being at that program. Initially it was just the uncertainty of the whole aspect of Tudong, but realizing that, so there's these stories or people having that experience of doing Tudong, but then how do you take that into your daily life? And so I was kind of reflecting on that most of the rest of today. One of the things that came pretty obvious to me is like when we talk about the Buddhist teachings, or if someone does, for the first time, come in contact with it, or just every time we bring it up, it's like the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. And living in a monastery or living at home or in our, we get our routines, and we tailor our routines to what's comfortable for us, what's easy or pleasant. Even if it's living in a monastery where there is a form or a schedule, and you may not even like most of the things that actually happen on the schedule. Like you maybe don't want to get up as early as the schedule does, or you don't like the work period, or you don't like the solitude, or whatever it is. But we have strategies and ways of getting around that, and so. I was just reflecting, on the walk, especially the first couple of days, the first day in particular, there's this real, for me, there was this real sense of actually being afraid, of that, the uncomfortableness of the uncertainty. And so that was the predominant that came up. And then, but it was quite interesting as soon as we had gotten dropped off and the monastery vehicle pulled away, it was like that. Actually, that fear kind of dropped because it was like, okay, well, it's already started. The walk has begun, and now you just be in the present moment. Before it was always all these speculations of what ifs, but now it's sort of like just you're in the present moment, and that's okay. But the first day that we actually walked, I was just reflecting on just like moment to moment, like all the things that you're reacting to. If you've ever been on Highway 1 on the coast, it's a very narrow road, and in many places, there's actually no shoulder at all. I'm glad I don't drive a vehicle, because after walking that road, I don't know if I'd actually drive it, because there's certain places where maybe you don't notice when you're driving, but there's no shoulder and there's a very long drop into the ocean. But you notice this when you're walking, because if a vehicle did come around the corner, there's no place for you to go either. So it was some places it was very, very dangerous, and you're always constantly, watching out. It's a positive experience, because you have to be present in the moment and not lax. So you're constantly looking out for your safety. Like, is this the right side of the road to be on? So there are many places we had to continually switch back and forth to which side of the road we were on, but there was this, constant, just a slight bit of fear, like, okay, is this safe? And then as you start walking, it was interesting, like, how much of the day when you're actually out there is just adjusting or just paying attention to the needs of the body. And this is where I was like, we can say, yeah, okay, the first noble truth is that there's dukkha there, but, living here, you know basically how to take care of yourself. It's kind of habitual. But when you get out there, on the road, it was a continual, like almost every 15 minutes, there had to be some sort of adjustment you had to do to your body, either, putting on suntan lotion or sunblock, we weren't trying to get suntans, but we were trying to, block ourselves from getting sunburned. So you're putting on the lotion and then, the kind of chapstick, so you're not getting your lips burned. And then it's extremely windy, so you have your windbreaker on, and your hat's being blown all over the place, and you're trying to keep it on so you don't get sunburned. And then the weather changes, and then all of a sudden the wind's not out, and then you realize you're too hot, so you're taking your jacket off. And then you've gone a couple hours, and now you're starting to get a blister on your foot, and so you stop and you kind of adjust that. And so it's just, then you have to stop and drink water. And sometimes, this didn't happen on this particular walk, but we were able to find water quite easily. But in other walks that I've done, we've had to then actually go and ask people. It's one of the kind of few things that a monk can actually ask for, just go and just let their... know that there's a need, that you need water. And so there's just, all these little things that you have to be paying attention to. And so the walk really brought up that continual, it was almost, every 15 minutes, is these subtle adjustments to taking care of the dukkha of the body. When I've done walks in the past, I just wanted to kind of just tell three stories from this one. But when I've done walks, I've just over the kind of history of it or the experiences from the past walks, I've come to, I think, one conclusion that I think really works with a walk, and that is, especially when you're walking completely on faith, is not to turn down generosity. I think there's something that, it's a universal consciousness or something, but it's like when you start turning down that sort of generosity, like I think it cuts something off. And so, unfortunately, the very first day, the very first encounter we had, I broke that law. So we were just maybe an hour outside of Westport, and came to the very first kind of rest area that for drivers, and there was a couple were there from Switzerland, and they actually looked like they had flown their camper kind of truck over to the United States, and they were taking, looked like about a 6 month kind of tour, and I don't know how long they'd actually been here already, but they were planning on going all the way up into Alaska, and so it was like another big adventure. And we had just a short conversation with them, asking them questions. They were asking what we were doing, and then one of them asked if we wanted a cup of coffee. And it was a chilly, really, really windy day. And I remember just thinking that I was really trying to stay hydrated. I didn't want to. And then when she offered the coffee, I was like, my initial thought was, well, that would potentially be a dehydrate you. And we actually just had eaten an hour before, so we weren't really hungry. And so I said no. And then it wasn't until later in the day I kind of remembered, that's one of the my cardinal rules is don't turn that down. And it was interesting because then the rest of the day we didn't actually see another person, didn't have any interactions with anybody. And that was fine because we found a really nice place for shelter that night and actually didn't need to be in contact with anybody. And that was one of the themes that also sort of came up, or not a theme, but just one of the overall tone of the walk was that we got just enough support. It wasn't like we had lots and lots of contact with, many, many people. Metika at the Three Jewels had put out a notice for her group that that we were going to be there on Saturday, and she'd invited us for the meal. And I think she was hoping that there'd be a large gathering, and it'd be a kind of a teaching opportunity and to just interaction with the monks. And just a few people showed up, and I think she was a little bit sad about that. She was probably hoping for a little bit more. Maybe not, but I think she kind of expressed that. But the food that everybody brought, and she made some, and I think it was three people showed up, the food that they brought, it was the perfect amount for a meal. So it was like we didn't need any more people to show up. And that was kind of like what happened through the rest of the walk. It was like if we needed alms food, it was like, two people offered food on the next day when we were on alms round, and it was the perfect amount. And so partly it was like we were paying attention to that too. It's like, well, what are our needs? So it's like when we were on the alms round, it's like, as soon as we had, just the bare minimum that would get us to survive the next day, we would put our alms bowls away and go someplace and find a place of solitude to eat. So like we weren't being greedy. We weren't trying to get like, oh, I don't like this, this offering that they gave us. I'll wait for a better offering. It's just, okay, this will get us through to tomorrow. And then we just moved on. So that first encounter with somebody just turning down their generosity was kind of like, okay, let's learn from that. Let's kind of be more open to that. So then the third day that we were walking, we're south of Fort Bragg, and if that part of the coast is there's not really any long stretches of beaches. It's not good for walking on, so you have to be on the road most of the day. But there were a few kind of detours or side streets that you could go down. And it would take 20 minutes to a detour to go down to those beaches. But we did that on a couple of occasions. And then also just a long alms route waiting to receive offerings kind of put us further back. We didn't get as far as we were hoping to get that day. And then this stretch of Highway 1, where people drive on the vehicles is flat and it was really nice, but the sides of the roads, probably for drainage, was quite a steep incline on the side of the road. And there's a stretch that was that kind of incline was almost about a mile long, or even more than that. And I started to get an injury on the inside of my foot just because of constantly walking on a very steep incline. And there wasn't any place else to walk. On the other side was just this kind of like cliff or a really steep cut in the earth to make the highway. And I heard later that a couple of monks last year did the walk, and what they were doing on that same stretch, one of them got hurt as well. But they were like every couple hundred yards, they'd switch sides of the road and walk on one side and walk on the other. So it was pretty extreme in terms of walking. And but we got to the town of Casper, and there's kind of two exits. You can go to Casper, and I decided, yeah, let's just keep walking, and we talked about we had several invitations to for people in the town of Albion, and we were thinking of not being there for another day or two, but just we were further, you know, further back in the day, and getting this injury, and I was like, well, let's just call the people in Albion. And there were two offerings, so we'll maybe just go up to there, and then the next day we can actually just go and meditate, be on a beach, and got to Casper at the community center there, and they let us use the phone and called one of the contacts, and he's like, well, actually I'm on the road right now, and I'm really close to there. I'm heading off to a meditation group. He said, I'll be there in like 5 minutes, and so. Just like that, we were picked up, and he took us to a zendo. That he was a Zen priest. This man who picked us up, and I just found it hilarious. I was sitting there in meditation in this beautiful zendo in a redwood forest, and I was thinking, you know, just an hour ago, I was like, you know, my foot was really hurting and you know, sweating, and just taking again like all every 15 minutes having to adjust to the, you know, the pain or the discomfort of the body, but just that sense of reaching out, asking for help from somebody, just literally within an hour of doing that, here we were sitting in meditation with a group of Buddhists who were, everybody was supporting each other in this meditation. And I was just like, wow, there's a lesson here, you know, learning to be able to ask for help and just, you know, seeing the beauty of came from that. Like, it would have been fine to have, you know, pushed through the pain and have walked another couple hours to get to where we were hoping to camp. But it was also fine to, we had an invitation to call and then to, you know, be in contact with people like that. So the last story was, the last day that we were walking, we were on 128, Highway 128, and heading to Boonville. And I knew we wouldn't be able to walk all the way there, but after we'd walked about 6 miles, and we had told the person that was we were going to connect with that morning that we would try to get to Boonville, either just walking along the road, hopefully somebody would pick us up, or if not, if she showed up at Boonville at 11, we weren't there. She was going to drive down to this town of Navarro, and we were almost to Navarro at that point. And several people had told me that if you're going to be hitchhiking on these really windy roads, the best place to do it is if you're what is a turnout for slower traffic. And if you get kind of at the very beginning part of the turnout, if you're hitchhiking, then people can see you and they can pull over. You know, easily, and it's about, you know, other places they're not going to stop because it's too dangerous. And so we got to a place like this just before Navarro, and I was sitting there for again, you know, taking care of the body, had to change, get out of the cold clothes we were wearing in the morning, and so Tantanavro was off doing that, but I was just kind of sitting there on the edge of the bridge for about 10-15 minutes, and he finally came. When he came up, I was like, it's interesting. I just said, let's just try hitchhiking for three vehicles, just three. And if nobody in that period of time, you know, those next three cars, if they don't pick us up, we'll just start walking, and then our contact will find us. But I wanted to at least give it a try, The next two vehicles that came by had they were pickup trucks with dogs in the back of them, so we decided we didn't stick our thumb out for those. And then I saw a car coming. Okay, this looks good. And just as I was sticking my thumb out, I see out of the corner of my eye this a vehicle coming the other direction, and it swings around, and the guy rolls the window down. He motions for us to come over. So I didn't even have to stick my thumb out because this guy was doing this completely on his own initiative. And so we walk up to the car, and he's like, do you guys live in an ashram? And I was like, well, we're Buddhist monks and we live in a Buddhist monastery. I see him kind of nodding. He goes, well, you know, what are you doing out here? So I explained to him we're on a walking pilgrimage and he's walking on faith. And he's kind of nodding again. And he looks at me and goes, what are the three refuges? And I was like, that's a, you know, okay, Buddha, like, how does he even know that? But I was like, I asked him later, I said, what would you have said if I had said chocolate cake, sleeping in, and watching movies, you know? Yeah. I said, Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And he said, okay, get in. He was testing us. He told us later, he said he didn't actually kind of believe his eyes that he'd seen two Buddhist monks. He was like, you know, somebody else joked later, it's like, yeah, we were trying to cash in on the riches of being Buddhist monks, you know, sort of running around redwood forest in robes, but he turned up being a really interesting and really nice guy, and lots of really good questions. But he had sat at Insight Meditation Society and Spirit Rock, and just a really nice conversation we had with him. He drove us all the way to Boonville, and then offered us the meal. But that was a really profound kind of encounter for me because, you know, for one thing, it was kind of, I thought it was kind of even weird hearing myself say it, but I said, you know, let's just try hitchhiking for three vehicles, and that's it. It was sort of like, you know, not really like, you know, we're going to sit here until we get a ride. It wasn't that kind of attitude. It was just like, well, it's just, I was kind of intrigued because I've never actually hitchhiked in the United States. I've done it in New Zealand when I lived there. And even in New Zealand, you don't need to actually stick your thumb out. You just, as a Buddhist monk, you just stand on the side of the road, and people are very inquisitive there. And it's just, it is a hitchhiking kind of culture in certain places. And when we've been on Tudong in New Zealand, it's people would just naturally stop and pick you up. So I was intrigued. Just kind of wanted to see, you know, what would happen. Three cars, if people ignore us, okay. But I was telling Tantanavro too, it's like, I think there's a culture in California in particular, that in this area in particular, that even though we've been, you know, walking along on the road for 3 or 4 days, only one person had kind of slowed down and offered us a ride. And I had that in the back of my mind, you know, don't say no. So I was going to have them just drop us off at the next town up. And he had to go again to turn the vehicle around because it was a kind of a dangerous area. And then he ended up, must have changed his mind because he didn't come back. But that was the only person also in all of those miles that we walked that even did offer to ride. But I had this, you know, real strong suspicion that if we had, you know, let there be known that we had a need, or if we did have a need, or just, you know, stuck the thumb out, that people would have stopped. It's like there's a real strong sense of generosity, and people would have probably trusted us, you know, seeing us as Buddhist monks, they probably would have picked us up. But there was a sense of without putting the thumb out, they were just like, well, you know, they're doing something, they're on their own. So there's this real sense in Northern California of, you know, not sort of imposing yourself on others, or they're doing what they're doing, and you just let it be. But I really strongly think if we put our thumb out, we probably would have gotten a ride, but we didn't need one until that last day. I think, again, one of the other things about the Tudong I've been contemplating is that, I think this form really works, doing Tudong and just the way people respond to it, partly because it is a form, you know, it's coming from within a practice that the Buddha had actually recommended. There's been enough of us that have tried it in the United States that we have a little bit of history with it and have some experience. And those of us that have done it, we always talk to each other about it and pass back and forth, you know, sort of knowledge about it. And so that there is this sort of, you know, building, tradition of doing that. Yeah, another conversation on the Willits routes was just talking about that, how actually, you know, having a form, having a container can actually sort of, you know, lead to, we're talking about in the sense of like the icon paintings that I was doing last year, the workshop over at Mount Tabor, that, you know, having this this form that you put yourself into, you know, once you've, you know, sort of mastered, or, you know, you get the technique down, it actually brings out the creativity. It brings out the, say, inquisitive, the part of the mind that starts to, you know, really, you know, question, or to, invigorates the mind. I was pointing out with the icon workshop, it's like, you know, everybody was doing the exact same icon, and at the end of the, you know, end of it, even though there was, you know, completely different skill levels of everybody that was doing it, you know, everybody's icon came out, you know, really beautiful. But I could also see that, you know, in the process of, you know, putting yourself into that form of that particular, you know, say, painting style, or in this situation, say, of this particular tudong, you know, or any type of practice. So it's like, you know, very aware here that there's a, you know, and was it 3 weeks or so? There's going to be a couple of four ordinations happening. So people are, you know, taking on the training, and a couple of the Anagarikas are going to become novices, and the two novices hopefully will become fully ordained bhikkhus. And so they're, you know, putting themselves into a new form, and you know, they've been here, they've been training for a year or two, and so they have, you know, some familiarity, but they're going to have, you know, new expectations or new rules, new ways of being, or old ways of being that they know how to do, or their comfort levels will be taken away from them a little bit. And so I see, like, you know, just, you know, by putting yourself into the form, you know, learning the rules, you know, knowing the etiquette, that some people can, even living here for quite a long time, can resist that, or, you know, feel restricted by that. But partly it works because everybody that's here, I think, you know, every single person in this room is here because, you know, you asked to be here. You know, it's like you asked to come as a guest, or you asked to ordain here. And so, you know, we bring ourselves to the training. And then, you know, once you get the form down enough, then the mind can sort of, it frees the mind up to start, like, okay, well, to actually have joy with it. It's like to start thinking about, well, okay, yeah, I do struggle with this particular issue, or, you know, this situation is uncomfortable. You know, why is that? You know, why is it uncomfortable? Or how could I, you know, see this in a different light? It's like when I'm you know, working on a painting or something, it's like it's quite joyful to come across an obstacle. It's like, you know, and sometimes you have to do, like, I might be working on a particular color scheme and I really want it to work, but after a certain point, it's like, no, this isn't going to work, and you just have to try something completely different. Or sometimes you just got to take the piece of paper and crumple it up and throw it away, you know, and start again. And but you learn from, you know, the mistakes. You learn from where your obstacles, the difficulties are. But you really wouldn't see it if you didn't have the form, the putting yourself into a situation where there is that, you know, there's some rules and guidelines for where to work with it. Last night, I knew I was going to be giving the talk tonight, so I was kind of reading a few suttas and kind of tie this together. I was telling Tantanavro a couple times that we spent a lot of time meditating, just overlooking the ocean. Yeah, it's really quite a, you know, in all the years that I've lived here, You know, I've never probably spent more than like an hour or two, on the coast, because we will drive over and spend a little bit of time and then get back in the vehicle and drive back. And so I've never had that opportunity just to spend like 24 hours just on the coast at one time. And one of the things that really brought up for me is again the uncertainty, but it's a little bit of fear. It's like I grew up in a landlocked part of the United States, so I've never been around the ocean. So there's so much unknown about the ocean that I wasn't losing any sleep by being next to it. But I could just see that it's like I would never feel comfortable just going out and going for a swim in the ocean. Watching that. So last night I was just reading a couple of suttas and came across one of it's in the Anguttara Nikaya. I think it's called the Four Perils, and it's the Buddha's kind of using this the four perils for someone going into the water or going into an ocean. And this is a kind of instructions to people who are just getting ready to ordain. He uses this analogy for them, or someone who's just recently gone forth. And he goes through and he says, the four perils are, see if I can remember this, is waves, crocodiles, which I didn't think we had to worry about those, but I was worried about waves, crocodiles, whirlpools, and fierce fish. So those are the four. I could relate to three of them on this walk. Tsunamis was probably the fourth one that I was a little bit worried about. But so then the Buddha then sort of says, for someone who's gone forth, they've seen the dukkha in the world, and they're seeking a way out. That's why someone does come to a monastery. That's why someone does seek the training. They have confidence that coming to a monastery might give them some new insight into that, or give them a practice to find the end of suffering. So they, shave their head, put on white robes or brown robes, or requesting the bhikkhu robes, and so they have confidence in this. But there are these perils, and so the parable of the waves, the Buddha uses that as an analogy for, say, anger and ill will. And so he says, someone's, come to the monastery, they've ordained, and they came here for very pure intentions, but then all of a sudden people are telling them what to do. It's like, you're destined to work in the kitchen today, or, don't do things this way, do it this way. Instructing you and criticizing you, even sort of pointing out where you've broken rules, or just all sorts of everybody here probably has experiences of that. Even if you're just a short term guest, if someone coming up and pointing out you don't put your shoes there, put it here, and that the dukkha of that, and the Buddha warns, is that is one of the perils that could cause somebody to disrobe. And then so the next one is the crocodile. And this is an analogy for gluttony. So and he goes through like all the food rules or rules that we have around when we can eat, what we can eat. And so he goes through this whole thing of monks, sort of again instructing the new candidates, you can eat this and you can't eat that, and you can drink at this time and you can't drink that, and he's just going through all the different sort of permutations of that. And then the person reflects, well, before I was a monk, I could eat anything I wanted to, I could eat whenever I wanted to, I could drink whatever I wanted to. I could even drink alcohol if I wanted to. Just going through all this, and so they get discouraged and they disrobe. So then that's the analogy of the crocodile. And the whirlpool was again kind of the same sort of story goes on that but this is for the five sensual cords of sensuality. And here the Buddha uses kind of a beautiful, sort of sets it up with the, you know, a monk is going on alms round or has to go into the village, or our situation going on tudong, where you're kind of out of the monastery where it's a fairly protected situation. And the Buddha says that the monk is negligent in not setting up mindfulness. So it's they go into the alms round and they hadn't set up an intention in their mind to kind of guard their sense faculties, their sense, paying attention to what you're watching, what you're listening to, what you're talking about. And so that, as a result of not setting up that mindfulness, then they see sights that are of people indulging in sensuality in various ways. And then, the mind comes in with, craving, I wish I could, get that. Or, and so because of that dissatisfaction of not being able to do that, they also have the reflection that, when I was a layperson, I could indulge in those things. And so they get discouraged and leave the training. And then the last one of the fierce fish is it's in the suttas. It's the Buddha's talking to male monastics, so he uses the analogy of a woman. But it's whatever you're attracted to, that would be what it was. So if it's if he was talking to bhikkhunis, he'd be saying it would be men, but then again, it's the same situation, sort of a monk, going into a village or going into a town and not setting up mindfulness, that just to pay attention to sense restraint. And then because he hasn't done that, then he sees a beautiful sight, sees a beautiful person, and then is assailed by lust. And then because of that, they get frustrated, like, oh, I used to be able to indulge in that as a layperson. So just in conclusion, if anybody is staying until midnight, Tantanavaro can counter with different stories or tell you the way he experienced the tudong, because I'm sure every time I think about it or bring it up, there's just many different ways of what you can learn and understand or bring Dhamma to from this practice of really putting yourself in a uncertainty. And even though I'll be with them for another 3 weeks or so before their ordinations, I wish the candidates for the next ordination the best of success, and wish everybody success. So I'll end the Dhamma talk here.